This is Zell Cui, and we'll talk about political ethics today. And I want to start out by saying that there are responsible, ethical people in government. The reason why I say that, and I think politics is a noble profession, is that when I get going on this, my wife Gretchen says to me, hey, you're giving the impression that the whole thing's a whole bunch of evil and everybody ought to go away from it. And the system does produce good things. I mean, just up there before we're talking about, and there's a big concern about clear cutting of forests, for instance. But when we look at it, the other side, I'm really impressed that in 1929, we set aside the Gila National Forest, and or the Gila Wilderness in the Gila National Forest. I mean, that was the beginning of the wilderness, and was involved with setting some parts of the nation aside for wilderness area, namely the Scapegoat Wilderness up in Montana, because I was up there and worked on that in Congress when I was there. When I see that, and the fact that there are more people stay alive when they travel on the interstate than when they did on those two-lane highways, when all the folks who are driving home back to Baltimore, wherever they're going. I mean, to those things, there are some good things that government is doing. I want to throw that up to you to begin with, that we can be happy that we have pure food. A few times we do eat meat here. Then, if there wasn't any such regulations like that, I mean, I think that's good. I didn't want to put that thing up in front of us. However, the problems of ethical behavior continue to confront us. It's confronted us for a long time, because the first meeting I went to after I came here was to Esther's Bible study on Eve. And the first thing we know, as soon as the stories go of wrongdoing in the story in the Bible, and then if you went further, their first son was a murderer too, and so you look at that, and all through the scriptures of the evil and unethical behavior of human beings, and you wonder if there's any hope. But there are consequences, and there the whole of the scripture moves us through the hope that is really there, despite the evil and wrongdoing that people have. But getting away from the scriptures to the present time, I've really been dismayed because of a close friend of mine in Minnesota. Senator Durenberger is in the news so much of his wrongdoing. Now, if he was a scoundrel who I didn't like the way he voted and the way he approached legislation, you know, it'd be a lot easier for me. He just got what is coming. But Durenberger comes about as close to operating the way I like to see a person operate. I mean, he thinks deeply about legislation, works on it, develops it. He's a legislator. He's not a person who's merely spending his time back campaigning or just doing the ombudsman work, helping his constituents with problems with government, but really tries to help in a number of the areas in the health field. And I found him to be open to ideas that he hasn't agreed with as well. So you get a person like that, and then now he had, he did, the best thing you say, he did some dumb things, but he did, I think, skid over the edge of the law, or the rules, on both his apartment and using that book company in order to get money where he couldn't receive it at honorariums. It'll help him, I believe, the fact that he's open about it, never tried to hide it. Just like I think the difference between David and Saul was that while David committed adultery and had her husband killed, and he sneaked that thing through, he was quickly to be open about it to God. He didn't try to hide it when he was confronted by the prophet. And Saul, when he took those animals, and he tried to hide it all away, and then finally said, well, the reason he kept them aside was to offer them as a sacrifice to God. You know, he never admitted his guilt. and that. And I said, so I look at Durenberg as that's the case with him. We have a little different situation with Oliver North, who was lying to the Congress, and to but I think it makes a difference on which side a person is on. In all these cases, it makes a difference on what side a person is on, because the people who agree with the outcome or the ones who are benefited tend not to look at the means the way those who are either opposed to the outcome or aren't benefited by it at all. I'll give you an example outside of that is what amazed me with when the corruption that existed with the Teamsters, that Teamsters members stuck up for their leaders and used David Beck, I think he came from out in this part of the country one time, quite a long time ago. Anybody that doesn't have gray hair like mine doesn't even remember David Beck before Hoffa, head of the Teamsters. But the reason why the Teamsters did not object to his criminal activity was that they actually did benefit as members of the union. They didn't look far enough ahead of absconding with some of their pension funds, but at least initially they were. So they did not have the same attitude towards him. And those of us who had no benefit from it at all that we could see looked at the means in which David Beck used, and it was totally wrong with us. And there's a tendency for us to be that way. And so in the case of Oliver North, if people were very strongly opposed to the Sandinistas and supported the Contras, you know, they would look at that differently. They would look at it similarly with breaking the law the way blacks broke the law in the civil rights movement, because it was the law, the rules, that they should not eat in the same lunch counters or sit in the same lunch counters with whites. And when they sat in, you know, that was breaking the law. They had to sit in the back of the bus, and when they refused to sit in the back of the bus, they refused to break the law. So somebody would say, but Oliver North did it at the same time. And there are sometimes when you're so upset the way the majority goes or the way the law operates, you ought to break the law. And I think that's true. There are times when you do that. But I think there's a basic difference in that between North and the civil rights movement is that the people who broke the law did it openly. They were willing to suffer the consequences. They weren't hiding for what they were doing, and North was hiding what he was doing, was not doing it openly, rather than confronting all of society if he truly believed that the track that we're going on and not supporting the Contras was wrong. He should have moved into the political arena and addressed that issue to change the thinking of the majority if they were not going ahead and doing it. The other part in ethics now is all of the media treats personal ethics differently than they had before. And I remember when people told me about the sexual exploits of Senator Kennedy and after he was President Kennedy. And I thought they were making it up. I thought there were people who disliked Kennedy and were just using that to malign a person. And I mean, if anybody should have believed them, it should have been me, because I was on the other side. I mean, I was in a different political party than President Kennedy. But now you find out all that to be true. I talked to reporters who knew it at that time, and they just chose not to divulge that kind of information. I think it's Watergate that turned the corner for us with the press, to where now they would do such things as stake out Gary Hart and check on him. And so those personal things become a question that comes up in the campaign. My own feeling is that if you become a public figure, I think you become public property. And I think we are treated differently. And our private lives need, it's all right to expose our private lives and let people make their judgment on how we operate. But it's very difficult, I think, in our making those decisions now, whether they should or not. Now, besides those ethical questions, we have the other ethical questions that are on a broader perspective and on how the Congress ought to act. And probably for the longest number of years now, the hottest issue of all has been abortion. And that is purely in the political arena, but very difficult to talk about and discuss because the positions are so adamant on each side. And but it's, I believe, is absolutely an ethical question. And the example of Minnesota this time, instead of the usual legislative processes, try and determine where the majority would go or where you can reasonably compromise in order to resolve some of the differences. For, there was an attempt by a number of legislators in the Minnesota legislature to develop a compromise. One is to permit abortion in the case of rape and incest, but not abortion on demand, and others to try and codify the law just the way the Supreme Court had made this determination now. But the opponents to abortion were so strong and pure in their views that they turned against what seemed to be, in some cases, a majority position for that compromise legislation to permit abortion and rape and incest and not the other, and defeated the legislation. And the minority leader of the Senate, who took that position and had had a pro-life position all the time, did not even get endorsed in his convention for re-election. And on the other side, the person who had proposed the legislation, John Brandel, to, I think, pretty much codify the way the law is now, the pro-choice purists were so strong that they even opposed that effort in legislation. And so that's the difficulty that I see in the whole legislative process. You don't hold people responsible, perhaps, in the same way as you do with personal ethics or the influence that comes to bear on individuals. But those are questions that we need to confront. And there are all kinds of other ones, too, that we need to confront and are trying to confront. The whole movement and pressure towards the use of capital punishment. When I was governor, I was really pleased that we hadn't had capital punishment in Minnesota and we didn't have that issue before us. It wouldn't even come up in the legislature. Because frankly, that was the toughest decision I had to make in a moral and ethical question where I was going to come down on capital punishment. And it took me a long process to do that. But what I found that every time the question came up in the Congress, I voted against capital punishment. And it wasn't until, as I mentioned last night, that I became a friend of a person who killed his father, his mother, and his oldest sister, came to know Jesus Christ, that I came to the conclusion that I could not support capital punishment. And but the movement is towards capital punishment, even legislation is introduced now. And even a state like Minnesota for capital punishment. And so that's, I believe, is the move in which we're going and have to make ethical decisions in our political life. The I'd like to, now before we get into the whole area on that ethical decisions that people make, and I'd like to just take a look at that whole question of political ethics and in politics, because I'm intrigued with Christ's confrontation with that in the temptations. And I think that nations are really, you can look at them as an economic sphere and a political sphere and a belief sphere. And I think Christ was tempted in all three of those areas. And that, as I look at that, was an economic temptation when the devil offered him tempted him to turn stones into loaves of bread. And there's a number of nations in this world that if somebody could turn stones into loaves of bread, they could take over. And I think Christ at that time, at the beginning of his ministry, it was right after he had been baptized, was truly faced with that temptation, otherwise it wouldn't have appeared in the Gospels the way it was. I think the other one was truly a political temptation when he took him to a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world, and said, if you'll bow down and worship me, that the devil would give them to him. And to me, when I look at that, I think that the devil is the leader in the political world. And when Christ uses the term calling the devil the prince of this world, I myself think that was a political term, and that wasn't just a big lie on the devil's part, and that we have some special temptations and dealing with that arena. And however, I believe we have a responsibility to work in the political arena. And I'll just throw it in for my views. I think the spectacular religiosity was the other temptation. If you do have certain spiritual prowess or abilities, there's really tremendous temptation to use that to your own advantage rather than to God. And that's why he took him on the pinnacle of the temple and told him to jump off. And he wouldn't have hurt himself, you know, it would have been a great spectacular thing for him. But on the politics part of it, I think Christ went through that and saw the temptations. And I look at politics then as, in one way you can look at it as the art of government. In the other way you can look at it as power. Because people go into politics, I think, for three reasons. One is for power, and the other one is for recognition. I think there's a third one that a lot of people leave out, and it is for service, to serve. And I think there are people who go into politics in order to serve. But power is an enormously powerful impact on people's lives. And in John Galbraith's book on power, to me, he did a very succinct job of explaining how that operates, but made it a little clearer in my mind. I just wanted to throw that out briefly for you. And he looks at three instruments of power. One is the person, and the second are things, material things, and the third is organization. And so you see with a person, a charismatic person has greater power. And I find it fascinating. When I was still contemplating running for re-election for governor, I chose not to run again. But a woman came up to me and said, I can tell you how you can win a re-election. And I said, well, how's that? And she would show me how to dress. And come to find out that blue is power. If you want to believe every word you say, you wear black. Brown is no power. Gray is warmth. And I realized, I went up to WCCO radio, and four people came out of a management executive training program. Five women and one man. And all of them wore blue suits. All of them wore blue suits. And afterwards, women comment to each other, I'm wearing my power suit today. Because they recognize that. And I recognize the power in the person, and you can learn those ways to utilize the means in which you can gain power with people. And just in the idea of dress. The second part of it in things, material goods, I mean, money is power. And but you just go to church, come out from church, and you see a Volkswagen Rabbit parked and a big black long Cadillac. And you won't pay any attention to who's going to get into that Volkswagen Rabbit, but everybody will kind of lengthen their conversation so that they can watch and who gets into that big long black Cadillac, because that person's got power. That's important to them. And I believe that's, when you look at all through our military part, and you see the use of weaponry or nuclear weapons as power, as a part of that. And the third is organizations. And a lot of the power that was once, I think, within material things are now engaged in conversation. We've dispersed power greatly. But I think that's what has been recognized in single issue politics, is that organization gives power. And if any of you have been engaged in politics to where you have multiple candidates on a ballot, you know that if you want your candidate to win, you do bullet voting. You just vote for one person. If there are six positions open and you're supposed to vote for six. If you want one person to get in, just vote for one and leave the other five go. I mean, just plain works that way. And single issue politics works the same way. And the use of organization for power. And I think that's why we have moved, there's a recognition for that, into single issue politics. I just want to lay that theory on you. And the other thing I want to do is just take a look at what my views are on ethics, because it came at a time when I was at the University of Minnesota, the Humphrey Institute, and we were talking about ethics and morality in government politics. And some of the people did not believe that anybody who votes does it from any ethical or moral point of view. It's only political and power. That's the only way. And had an altogether different view, as I had up to that time, of morality, ethics, and values. I'd looked at them all rather synonymous with each other. And I believe there's a transcendental source of morality, but I believe also there's a subjective determination and group determination on values. And to me, ethics kind of bridges those two. And so your values isn't just what the majority of people decide is good, but there are some things that I think just fit across all of society. And the best book that I read on that, for my information, was C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, because I was impressed by the Tao that ran through all of the religions through time that he lays out in his book. So I would like to take a moment now is to just get from you what you think are the attributes of ethical conduct in government. The attributes of ethical conduct in government, if you would just shoot out what you look for.
I would think one attribute that was short would be not self-serving.
Okay. And what would, could you put that on a positive?
It's a expression, positive thing in a sort of negative way. Yeah. You're screening out the things that you might do that would be for your own selfish good.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you don't decide your issue on the basis of, is it good for me, but rather, is it good for my constituents?
Would I say, if I said caring for others, would that be the same thing as not self-serving, or should I put not self-serving down? Would that be the positive way of caring for
others? I think so.
Okay. Can we say attentive to the public good? Is that more?
Okay, tell me attention to the public good. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I was offering that as the inverse of.
Oh, I see.
As a translation. Okay.
But it just sounds to me that it's a little more, it really means a little bit more than that. I kind of like that. But if you want to just explain that.
Well, I'm not prepared to
do
that.
Okay.
Good, because it doesn't always mean the majority or anything like that, but it's a phrase we certainly struggle with in these kinds of discussions. Mm-hmm.
I'll read Barbara, did you say something?
I think there's a tension, it's hard to know, I would look for someone who wouldn't just represent the constituency that elected them, even geographically, but would try to go for the good of the world and the nation, or, I mean, would try to really seek the highest level of public good and not just represent a constituency.
Okay.
Righteousness, I guess.
Righteousness.
Starts on the beatitudes.
I'm not kidding, I think righteousness is important.
Maybe this comes on that same one, but I think of personal integrity. And I think of Elliot Richardson's decision, to me, which was the most frightening time in our country, when he chose he would not knuckle under Nixon, but said no, you know. No matter what, he was going to stand for what was right.
Honesty?
Openness, not having a hidden agenda.
Okay.
I would say a certain level of effectiveness too. I mean, knowing how to be effective at working for your agenda. I mean, like skill as a politician, I guess.
I'd like to see courage there, because I think the ethical person often has to stand alone.
A vision for the world.
Somebody say it right here.
I'm not sure if incisiveness is the right word, but what I'm talking about is being able to focus in on what's the meat of the problem versus all the chaff and the false arguments. Being able to figure out what be able to focus in on the main issues, which may be different from custom and somebody's desire, but to be able to really tell the difference between what are the underlying issues and what are all the peripheral arguments.
Discernment?
Discernment. Clarity of thinking.
Priorities?
But
priorities.
Priorities can get you being elected your top priority.
You're right. That's cool.
Yeah, I would hope that wisdom would be in there too.
Try and get down with you. Said it.
Perhaps. Perceiving.
I'll put down clear thinking.
I would say biased in favor of the, I'm up here, biased in favor of the traditionally disenfranchised, whether they be poor people or people of color. Those who traditionally have not been empowered.
And I would add, like, commitment to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and protecting minorities. I mean, not trying to just go with popular sentiment when we want to constrain people's rights.
Citizenship would fit that.
I'd like some further elaboration on righteousness, because I can think of some circumstances where I might disagree with that. Okay. I'm probably pretty be in the group to stick my neck out and say that. But. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I couldn't try to hear you up here.
Let's see if we got some more down here, and then we'll go back to that again.
Endurance.
And
durability. resilient.
I'll do that for the lady.
Withstand criticism.
Withstand criticism.
Thick skin.
Oh.
Sensitive.
I like it, that you put it up. What about, have we got respect for others? Think that's sufficient in this?
What do you mean?
But, respect for others? Respect for people of a different point of view, people of a different culture.
See, that's what I'm getting at with righteousness, because I think there's a big gray area there with righteousness that I could disagree with, but respect for others, I think would fit the same category, maybe a little broader.
Uh-huh.
How about articulate?
Articulate. I run across some ethical people who aren't very articulate.
One thing I really admire is people who have both a sense of humor and can laugh at their own because they laugh at themselves, not take themselves too seriously. Because I think the pressures in politics are so much in terms of ego building.
Be really severe and great, and I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's kind of already.
Unseducible.
Independently wealthy, though. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, she mentioned vision, and I don't know if it's just an elaboration, but I'd like both a sense of time and also a broad viewpoint. Now, my broad viewpoint, when I took flying lessons, if we were at 1,000 feet, we could see this much of the circle. We got up to 10,000 feet, suddenly we could see a whole much more. So the perspective of being able to see your big picture and also see how it's going to extend through time, as opposed to, this is a hot topic for the moment, I've got the election coming up in a few months.
How would you put that?
I think that's long-term perspective.
Long-term perspective.
And it coupled with attention to the public good.
Uh-huh. Okay. One that I've looked at it is to be accountable. I was looking to see if
I'd like accountable better than promise keeping, because if the promise is a dumb promise to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd rather see Bush tackle the deficit than just stick to no new taxes.
Where's the way you look at it? Do you want to talk now any more about righteousness? I said I'd come back.
Well, my point is that as Jane was talking about the other day, what a Muslim person in Senegal thinks is righteous, what I think is righteous might be two different things,
mm-hmm.
but we both might end up at the same moral decision.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's righteousness from one point of view only, it has to go, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. How the rest of you feel about that issue?
I mean,
does righteousness go? Who had righteousness up there? Yeah, okay.
Well,
I
understand that the ambiguities around it, but I use it personally because I want our country to represent what I just can only describe as a righteous way of acting and treating others. And it's included in a lot of those other things. I look for that some of those qualities in a candidate, the same way I want our country to be honest, not to be deceitful. And so it's sort of a catch-all for me, but
so
if you're not comfortable with it, take it out.
Well, I'm wondering if
it doesn't reflect a particular religious point of view, but a rightness about decision-making that isn't selfish
But rightness and righteousness are two different things as far as I'm concerned. It's just a difference in semantics, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But maybe just some base of making moral decisions. I think we're both talking about that.
Mm-hmm. I think any leader has got to have a very strong, well thought out idea in his own mind as to what is right. And I would insist on him having that, even if his viewpoints on the subject are somewhat different than my own.
What's the term that King Arthur used at the end of Camelot to express that idea?
I don't know.
Right at the end of the musical, there's a big song, a big speech about rightness and righteousness. I don't remember what he uses.
How do you like the word fairness? Yeah, there's a shake of the head back there, so that isn't universally. I mean, sideways, not up and down. It isn't universally agreed to.
Well, it might take away a lot of stuff for me.
It was fair.
If we really got to be fair, you know, the privilege might lose a lot.
That's why I wondered if the word wasn't good.
Depends on how you define fair.
Yeah, fair tends to have a subjective nature.
We tend to accept 10-year-olds. Definition of fairness, which isn't necessarily what fairness is.
Well, as this group is together, that's a list of what you think are attributes of an ethical person who's in government to judge them thereby. I got three other questions I'd like to ask you. And one is, do you think that it's right to determine whether you want a person in office or not, what they do in their personal life? I think that ought to be strictly private, or do you think it ought to be public?
To me, it says something about their integrity, which mm-hmm. is the one that I think is important. Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is the event in their life at what time. Mm-hmm. Because if it's something in their past that they've come beyond and have changed, it shouldn't be held over their heads any longer. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that's negative to general society that is still ongoing in their life, then I think that has a great bearing on their worthiness to serve. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, should that be kept quiet because people might make their own judgment, or should that be out in the open and let people make a decision on it? Yes, Barbara?
Well, I was going to say, well, first of all, that Europeans, when I've been in Europe, think it's really funny that we are so attentive to politicians' personal lives. It's mm-hmm. very foreign to them, the idea that that has anything to do with anything. I would say, I'd ask the same question of people in the church or in ministry, and how much that should bear on your professional qualifications too. But I think there's a real distinction between personal conduct where there's a victim and personal conduct where there is. I mean, I would say that activity with consenting adults where it's not so clear that one person is a victim should not have as much to do with politicians being, you know, thrown out of office as it does. But I think that things, personal conduct, say financial or sexual or whatever, where one person is a victim, like a child or, I mean, things like that, I would make a real distinction there, as I would in the church, or abuse of a professional relationship. I mean, sexual harassment that involves using your position to victimize someone else. I think that then does enter the realm of conduct that should be a concern.
I think any person in a prominent position, whether it's a political leader, business leader, movie star, whether we like it or not, serves as a role model. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I think that everything visible in that person's life is of concern to us. Mm-hmm.
Well, and whether they should or shouldn't, we often make judgments based on our own moral system. So if a person is revealed to have been some kind of a cheater or a liar, well, naturally, you're going to think, gee, this isn't, cheating and lying is not what I elected this person for. And you assume that that's then going to kind of carry over. So you make a judgment whether it's right to do that or not, I guess.
Let me ask you a second question, and that is, should one's religious beliefs instruct one's political action? And this is based on Cuomo saying that his religious beliefs on abortion, for instance, would not affect the way, you know, he would vote on it. Do you agree with that? I don't mean on abortion. I assume we'd not get on that. But whether one's religious beliefs should instruct their political action or decisions.
I think one's political actions or decisions has got to rest on some underlying belief as to what is right. Mm-hmm. And if one is a religious person, that has got to rest on one's religion. So I would say the answer to your question is very definitely yes. Mm-hmm. It should rest on one's religious beliefs if one has one.
But when Kennedy was running, and this was an issue, could we have a Catholic president? He had to come out and say, my being a Catholic will not supersede my being president. Mm-hmm. And the people needed to know that.
I think the gospel clouds the issue there just a little bit, with Jesus saying, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God. And how do we interpret that in our lives today? Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that over a long period of time, a person's actions have to be consistent for that person to remain sane. I mean, that's how basic, I guess, I would view it. But you cannot have one belief system that you claim to subscribe to in one part of your existence and have no action, have actions that deny that belief system in another part of your existence. I mean, somewhere along the line, that's going to create turmoil. It's going to interfere with these other kinds of characteristics that you would like to see.
My response is similar to that, that a person that says that, to them, apparently religion is not a very important part of their life, that they can easily dismiss it. I think if religion were really one of their basic operating tenets, they would not find it so easy to put it aside. But if you're sort of a name-only religious person, you can say, well, of course, running religion isn't going to affect my decisions.
Are we thinking a lot here? We're all thinking religion, Christianity, I think. But there are a lot of things being done in the world today in the name of religion that Christians can find abhorrent or inappropriate, at the very least.
There are a lot of things that happened in the name of Christianity that
exactly.
Yeah.
Is abhorrent, too. I want to do this, and then I'm going to go on. I'll let you respond, then I'm going to go on for an explanation of this.
I was just going to ask to the group, what about a person who is an avowed agnostic or atheist, but who is a very moral, ethical person at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Well, that fits with what I'm saying, that a person has, I'm not pointing to any particular religious foundation, but a person has some guideline that they're functioning within, and I think it's part of my understanding of what makes you.
I'm going to just suggest, excuse me, I don't want to cut in before you're finished.
No, I was just thinking of a different way of saying what I said before, that a sane whole person has actions and words somewhat in coherence over the long period of time.
Let me suggest a book for you to read that you'd find fascinating, Religion on Capitol Hill, that Dr. Peter Benson and Dorothy Williams wrote back in about 79 or 80. After the bicentennial, Search Institute got a grant from the National Endowment on the humanities and did a study of the Congress and what their political beliefs were. And just in a nutshell, what they found is you can tell how a person is going to vote more by their religious beliefs than by their political party or anything of other nature. And while they divided the religious groups, and it wasn't just Christian with that, whatever they were in the Congress, although predominantly are Christian, but there are quite a number of Jewish people, some of other religions, and a few of none. But they kind of divided, they didn't divide them in six, but you could break those down for our perspective into two, the vertical and the horizontal. And what they found was those who have primarily a vertical faith, totally related to trying to find out their relationship with God, but ignoring other human beings, were very judgmental individuals, and they voted that way. And those who had a horizontal faith primarily were the ones who would tend more to be voting for welfare programs and reaching out to other individuals. And you could see by their religious beliefs where they're going to come down, which I think was a fascinating book, because after 200 years of this nation, we think so much of what our founding fathers believed in. It was good to look at what the elected officials did at that time. Yes.
I'm just curious whether the vertical and horizontal split along party lines.
No, it didn't, to their amazement. And they went into it expecting that it would split along party lines, but it didn't. And I think that just kind of opens up another reflection on how people are moving and thinking along those lines. But we can't solve all those problems at one time, and I see I'm running behind. I'd like to ask you what you think right now is the biggest problem in political influence. And you're going to say anything that exists out there now, to where there's political influence on people, where they might do things that you would not agree with, which then would maybe be something of value or maybe ethical, what would you say is the biggest problem?
Well, I think this problem of paying back favors, mm-hmm. just because he voted for your bill, mm-hmm. you must vote for his bill. Mm-hmm. I think that is a big danger.
So trading votes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you compromise on this matter? I've heard it said that the art of legislation depends on compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have seen compromises that were, in the end, not moral mm-hmm. or not good for people. Mm-hmm. I can think of a situation where our legislator voted with the tobacco lobby, for instance, in order to get their vote for the sugar lobby
and
the dairy. Yet we all are beginning to recognize that without doubt what tobacco does to the human race is less than desirable. And how do you resolve this?
You're asking me, and now we got the thing turned around. But since you did, I'll tell you that I made it a point when I was in Congress, so I'm kind of unique in this thing, but never trading a vote. And I never did trade a vote in the whole time. And it incensed me when I even put legislation together, like the Farm Bill, the Food Stamp Bill, together to force people to trade votes. So I did not, and I was an effective congressman. I was listed as one of the six most effective minority congressmen in getting his own legislation through. So I think it's possible not to trade votes, but you have to compromise. You don't have to trade votes to compromise. There are times when you, in order to get the essential. So I would not be one to speak for that. Although I know very strong ethical people, I won't use their names, but very admired by you folks, I think, the way they vote, who do trade votes and believe it is right to trade votes, so there is a difference of opinion on that. So I was trying to find out what you think was the biggest problem, because to me, right now, I think PAC money is the biggest problem we get out there. We need to do something about it. We're getting close to an end, and I want to share some of my accumulated wisdom with you. Just get some ideas about this, because you wonder what you're going to do about this, what you ought to do about it. And I just want to run through that, if I could, quickly. I think, number one, the more things can get out in the light, the better off we'll be. And so the fact that the press has changed and in many ways is offensive, I really, in the long run, figure is better for us. It's better have things out in the light, you can see them. Because evil can only operate in the dark. Evil can't operate in the light. And good operates in the light. So I say, number one, everything that could be done to lay everything out in the open so we could see it, I think would be good. Secondly, we've got to find a means where people can become educated. You know, what happens here, where Phil and Mavis talk about their experiences in Latin America, or what Mark does, and will be again this next session on prisons, it may be contrary to our political views, but it informs us, so we're going to make more intelligent decisions, even though we may not get lockstep exactly with them about it. We don't have the opportunity now, with 30-second sound bites and the inability to read, to learn about those issues and make decisions, because I believe the public opinion determines how members of Congress vote. And I've seen members of Congress go home in Easter recess and change their mind because they got home and talked to the people. So I'm more confident in the change, even though it took a long time to get through some of our heads, as it did in the Vietnam crisis. But I think that ethics can be taught and also experienced and needs to be a part of the education system and be a part of the whole training of anybody in government. I don't care whether it's the Congress or the legislature, the city council, or the county commissioners. It ought to be put in place to where people go through experiences in discussion and make decisions how they would do. For instance, if a person knew about the wrongdoing of another individual in the office or of the person who was in office, I mean, what responsibilities do you have in face like? I mean, you get all kinds of pressures on yourself to keep your job or what you do to that individual and hurt their life. I think it's important that one goes through those experiences, because when you're faced with them, you don't really know what's going to be the ethical decision that you ought to make and how that fits with the political decision that you're going to be confronted with. I think it's important who you do select for office. And I think those are ways in which you can do something about it. From what you were saying up there, the opportunity for self-deception is so great. Now, that whole business of, you know, in order to get along, you go along, or everybody does it, or the people don't understand, because that was a whole thing that we had, keeping everything quiet on Vietnam, you know, the people back home don't understand. If I do it, I may lose my job, or I don't have time for ethics. It's so important to get these jobs done, and it isn't my problem or responsibility. In some way, that needs to be heightened in the awareness, I believe, in people who serve in public office, and we need to bring that about. The self-protection is so great. And for instance, if you're going up the trail here and you met a bear was going to charge you, you don't really know all that you would do in you for your own survival. Things that would happen to you for your own survival, you just can't picture. And people in politics are the same way. As Toby Moffat said, he talked to other members of Congress who won by 52 or 53% of the vote. And he said their opponent now has amassed $500,000, they've only collected $70,000. And somebody offers them big bucks. I mean, the enormous temptation. They're faced exactly the same temptation as my friend who used to run a big crime operation in Washington, D.C. when he came out, the guy I was talking about, and he went straight. But he could run some drugs on a Saturday night and make $10,000. And he didn't have enough money to help his mother. You know, that's facing a survival mode on his part. And I don't say he never did go and sell drugs again. But he's still staying a pretty straight, I'd say. But it's, you know, you're running in that same situation that people need to be faced with in that area of survival and self-protection. But my hope is that on some of those enormous big issues that we have, and that I alluded to the other night, to me, one of the worst things possible, and now we're coming to the end, is the fact that we have spent our children and grandchildren's money to a far greater extent in this last decade than anybody ever dreamed we would do. Anytime we talk about deficits before, the you know, a quarter of our budget, I expect, will be used to pay interest on the debt if we, unless the federal budget keep going up an enormous rate. And I was mentioning to Barbara last on to have something like that happen, like the savings and loan situation, to that enormous cost to our taxpayers, which is over and above the huge debt they had. And from what I gather, there isn't a great deal of action of people being incensed at what's happened on that, trying to find out what will happen. And so we become so immune to unethical actions and moral conduct, I believe, that we need to take action and move into it. So that's my views. And tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about, if you really want to do something, how you can get the ear of people in government. Yeah, Barbara?
Well, okay, if I am incensed about the savings and loan, and I don't want this deficit to burden our children and grandchildren, then what do you do? I guess I can say tomorrow. How do I indicate that I'm incensed? Or?
Yeah, we're going to walk through that tomorrow, but you have to let them know and find out about it. There's ways of doing it. So that's what I want to talk about tomorrow. But I can get into it now, but we're going to ring a bell too soon for me. Yes?
I have been thinking about the savings and loan case as you were talking this morning, because it seems to pose sort of a next level of ethical dilemma, which is when there are unconscionable acts, and in my opinion, moving this bailout out of the federal budget, and so that we ended up paying $4 billion more in interest than if it had been part of the official U.S. budget, is unconscionable. It's a collective act. And so, you know, it seems like you focus this morning on personal ethics, and there are things that, as you say, we're almost immune to. The Congress, everyone in Congress just signs off. I mean, we discussed it a little bit in that case. They did discuss it. That's always encouraging to me, that they're conscious, that they're making a choice. But then, in my opinion, they made the unethical choice, because it's costing us more just to play this accounting game. Isn't that an even more difficult situation?
It surely is. But I wanted to get into what's personal responsibility first, and then let's move what we're going to do to get something done on the corporate sense.
One question I'd like to ask, it appears that with the savings and loan, it's almost like the whole Congress is banded together as a group to try to protect themselves. What do you feel about the 12-year limit on congressmen?
I joined with some others to advocate the 12-year limit. I got out in 20 years because I looked around and saw, didn't see anybody who was there longer than 20 years. I thought I'd still be there, and so why should I be any different than the others? But I think it ought to be shortened up, and I agree with the 12 years. To have more of a citizen legislative body, get some turnover with it. There's turnover, but not from elections. And I think we need to speed that up a little bit more. My favorite. It's over, folks.